Back in 1951, Louisiana Congressman Hale Boggs was worried that marijuana users were getting off easy. So he sponsored legislation that year and put his name on it. It was called the Boggs Act, and it was the first time that the federal government imposed mandatory minimum sentences.
Under the law, a conviction for first-time possession of marijuana would mean a minimum of 2 years in prison and a $20,000 fine. Since then, mandatory minimums have become a major fault line in the criminal justice system. Attorney General Eric Holder has crusaded against them, calling them unfair and ineffective.
And Massachusetts top judge Ralph Gantz, the chief justice of the state's Supreme Judicial Court, has done so as well. He says mandatory minimums mean harsh sentences for relatively benign offenses. He says they disproportionately penalize people of color, and that they take power away from judges and give too much of it to prosecutors.
But supporters say mandatory minimums have contributed to a dramatic fall in the violent crime rate over the past 2.5 decades, and that they're approved by lawmakers and represent the will of the people.
So we're going to hear two views now in our occasional series of Radio Boston debates about this. First, Daniel Medwet says that mandatory minimums have to go. He's a professor of law at Northeastern University and co-author of a recent Globe op-ed entitled Time to End Mandatory Minimum Sentencing. And Daniel Medwet, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Also with us is Dan Conley. He's district attorney for Suffolk County. He supports mandatory minimums. And Mr. District Attorney, good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And Dan Conley, if I could ask you to stand by, because I want Daniel Medwet to sort of lay out his case. Why should we end mandatory minimum sentences?
Great. Well, thank you, Anthony. It's delightful to be here with the district attorney. The case against mandatory minimums is predicated on three main arguments. First, it doesn't work. All of the empirical data suggests that it best, increased incarceration has a negligible effect on crime reduction, and it doesn't go at the root cause of many drug offenses, demand and addiction. Second, consider the expense. As the state's own data suggests, it costs more than $53,000 per year to incarcerate a single prisoner. Before we spend that amount of money, we should be pretty sure that it's working. And last but not least, the fairness issue. Mandatory minimum sentencing is premised on the idea of one size should fit all. But life is much more complicated than that. The low-level drug dealer on the corner is different from the high-level drug kingpin. But under mandatory minimum sentencing, they may be subject to the same sentence. So in a nutshell, those are the three main arguments.
Three main arguments. Okay, we'll get into those. But I want to ask you about the real consequences of this. Why should the average person out there listening to this care about this issue?
Think about the costs of incarceration, besides financial costs. By imprisoning someone automatically, without a judge exercising discretion, you're tearing apart families and you're taking them out of the workforce. And perhaps by sending them to prison, which in many respects may be a school for crime, you're perpetuating the problem. And you're not addressing the real underlying issue. Drug addiction. If drug dealers are off the streets, that doesn't mean that there's less drug activity. It just means that there are replacements. There are other people that are filling that market void.
Now, before I come to Dan Conley, I just want to ask you one more question. How many people are we talking about here in Massachusetts that are affected by what you see as a policy that doesn't work?
The data is quite interesting. According to the Department of Corrections' own website, about 10% of those incarcerated, currently incarcerated, not folks that have been convicted, but folks currently incarcerated, were incarcerated subject to mandatory minimum drug sentencing.
All right. So, Dan Conley, let me come to you. Suffolk County District Attorney, of course, you've said that mandatory minimum sentences help reduce crime and really explain why crime has fallen nationwide since the 80s. Tell us how.
Well, I think that's essentially irrefutable. You know, I have the benefit of having been here in this city all my life and in law enforcement for more than 30 years. In the middle 1980s, when I started my career as a young assistant DA, there was essentially open-air drug bazaars in virtually every neighborhood of Boston. The city was hemorrhaging population, and the violent crime rate was essentially through the roof. As a young homicide prosecutor, I was responding to homicide scenes, and there was about 150 each year in the late 80s and so. Then all of a sudden, here comes mandatory minimum drug sentencing, and district attorneys, my predecessors, began an intelligence-driven approach to incarcerating the worst of the worst, the most violent offenders, those who are trafficking drugs. And it's very important to make the distinction. The individuals who are subject to minimum mandatory sentencing are drug traffickers. There are no drug addicts in prison for being drug addicts. If they're there, they're there because they committed some other felony. Perhaps they broke into a house or they hurt somebody or robbed somebody or whatever. But there's nobody in prison in Massachusetts that I'm aware of, and I've challenged Governor Patrick, I challenged others. Please, if there is somebody doing a mandatory minimum sentence for mere drug possession, identify that person, and I'll do everything in my power to get them out. But here we have today, fast forward ahead 25 years later, I think we've had 7 homicides in the city. The first reaction I get was, well, it was a snowy winter. Okay, last year we had 60 homicides,
But in fairness, there really is debate about what has caused this drop in crime. I mean, you can get different theories from different people.
It's the sole cause. I'm saying it is a substantial contributing cause. Because we know the individuals that are driving the violence in our city. I mean, the police are getting better at this as well. And so that the approach that we take, we're not trying to put every person in jail. In fact, my office has prosecuted about 80,000 criminal cases over the last 2 years, and 4% of those individuals have actually received a committed jail sentence. So it's very important not to overlay problems with the federal government sentencing scheme and the sentencing schemes in the Deep South and suggest that Massachusetts is in the same situation. We're ranked 48th in the nation in terms of per capita incarceration. The Pew Foundation just released a study saying that Massachusetts saw a 14% reduction in its rate of incarceration over the last 5 years and is only one of six states, that it's predicting a further decline over the next 5 years.
All right. Well, I want to get Daniel Medwed to respond to a couple of these things, but let me just ask you to respond to something that Chief Justice Ralph Gantz spoke about recently when he talked about mandatory minimums. He spoke at a criminal justice summit at UMass last month, and he said this is more about prosecutorial authority than anything else. And this is what he said, quote, "When some district attorneys say they fear judicial leniency, they really are saying that they do not want to relinquish to judges the power to impose sentences that mandatory minimum sentences give to prosecutors." So, in other words, it's an argument about this is authority and, the decision to decide what the penalty, how the penalty should fit the crime. This belongs in the hands of judges.
Well, I was actually offended by that remark by the justice, who I know and I do respect. He really amped up his commentary at that summit, which I was at. In previous speeches, he had talked about a free exchange of ideas, and I'm certainly open to a free exchange of ideas. I differ from Professor Medved on this issue. I differ from the Chief Justice. But listen, don't demonize prosecutors. As I just mentioned, I am not in the business of incarcerating and warehousing people. Let's take, for example, there is a statute in Massachusetts that requires individuals who are caught selling drugs in a school zone to do 2 years mandatory minimum. In the last 2 years, in 13 and 14, 1,700 individuals were incumbent by this charge, and 63, we chose to insist that 63 of them, high-impact, violence-prone individuals, go to jail. Now, there are 900 inmates at the Suffolk County House of Correction. Think for a moment, if I was just trying to get a pound of flesh every time someone came before the court, there would be somewhere like 2,700 individuals down at the Suffolk County House of Correction. That's not the case. We're very discerning. And with respect to the court and the judges, we simply know more about what is driving the violence in our communities than they do.
All right. Well, Daniel Medwed, Dan Connolly put a lot on the table there, but I want to ask you this and then encourage you to respond to some of the points he made. There are mandatory minimum sentences for a variety of crimes in Massachusetts, including repeated drunk driving, armed robbery of the elderly, illegal possession of a gun. Should we revoke all of these laws?
I think we'd want to start with drug offenses to begin with and maybe then consider the other ones. Yeah. And here's why. As Mr. Connolly aptly noted, the mandatory minimum drug laws do not go after drug addiction. They don't go after drug possession. possessors. But what is driving the drug trade? It does go, they do go after drug traffickers and drug distributors. If not for the addiction, if not for the demand, there would be no supply. Data from the Department of Corrections indicates a belief that about 80% of folks who are incarcerated have some substance abuse problem. Whether it's the goal of the legislation or the effect, we are incarcerating people with drug addiction.
But respond to what Mr. Connolly said about the prison population in Massachusetts. I mean, clearly the U.S. locks up a lot of people. I think we lock up something like close to a quarter of the of all prisoners in the world are imprisoned here in the United States. But as Dan Connolly pointed out, we're 48th here in the U.S.
Well, simply because we're 48th in a country that has basically the highest incarceration rate in the country, save perhaps China and Russia, doesn't mean we can't do better. We should strive to do better. And I think Massachusetts, as is often the case, should strive to be the best in the Commonwealth, right? Not the third best. That's my first response. And then second, the idea of mandatory minimums actually causing the crime reduction. I take issue with that. Correlation, Anthony, is not causation. Studies, people who've looked closely at crime reduction, point to a host of factors: aging populations, rising income, changes in alcohol consumption. A report released just in February by the Brennan Center at New York University School of Law suggested that from 2000 to 2013, the rise in incarceration had zero effect on crime reduction.
Dan Connolly, I'd love to get you to respond to something that we hear all the time, and Chief Justice Gantz brought this up, and that is mandatory minimums disproportionately affect low-income folks and people of color.
You know, we looked at that issue recently. We compared the population, the demographic, the racial demographic population in the mid 1990s to what it is today. And actually, you'd be surprised to hear that the African American portion of the prison population has actually come down modestly. We have seen an increase in the Latino population as a segment of the whole, but we have also seen the Latino population grow exponentially here in Massachusetts. So I reject that, quite frankly, and I do not believe. You know, I certainly know that no prosecutor in Massachusetts is racially biased with respect to application of our laws. And I stand by that. However, let's be very candid. The criminal justice system, the courts, and the prisons are the repository of everything that has gone wrong, essentially, in our society. There's tremendous inequality in the quality of education that white students and African-American and Latino students get in this country. There is an incredible income inequality. There's more poverty in the black and Latino population. There's so much lack of access to health care. So, look, this is a very terrible problem in our country, this sort of inequality that exists between the races. But it's the criminal justice system that is the place where it all ends up when all those other systems fail.
And this might be one of the areas where you two are going to agree, and I'll turn to you, Daniel Medwet, here. I mean, perhaps something that you both can agree on, we're asking the criminal justice system to do so much in this country. I mean, arguably, it might go well beyond the abilities of the criminal justice system to deal with drug addiction, mental health, homelessness, all of these issues.
I think that's right, and I think Mr. Connolly's office is doing a good job of treating things holistically, and there's been a movement in the defense community toward holistic defense, it's called, which is to try to go to the real causes of criminal activity. So certainly that's something, and I don't know how the district attorney feels, that would be a benefit for all of us to move to a more holistic model.
Let me just ask you, Daniel Medwet, one more question, and we're going to be just about out of time. And this, Mr. Connolly, is something that you've raised, and that is mandatory minimum sentencing. It's not like the prosecutors went out there and said, we're demanding this. The voters approved it, and legislators passed these laws. So how do we deal with that?
Certainly. There's an issue of separation of powers here, Anthony. You have the legislature passing a law that's used by the prosecution. Given that 90% plus of people convictions are the result of plea bargains and not trials, whatever that original charge is often dictates the ultimate outcome. So what mandatory minimums basically do is they take discretion away from the judge. Judges who are actually there and who are unelected and not necessarily swayed by public opinion no longer have power over sentencing, over tailoring individual sentences. And that, I think, is a violation of our separation of powers. If not as a matter of law, then as a matter of principle.
All right, Dan Connolly, I gave Dan Daniel Medwood the first word. I'm going to give you the last word, but we literally have 10 seconds left, so if you would.
You know, judges have almost complete discretion over about 98-99% of all criminal statutes. In some limited circumstances, the legislature has modestly reduced their discretion, and this is an area where they felt that they must do so. They had to stop the revolving door of justice, and they've done that with respect to drug traffickers, and it ought to stay in place because it's done its job. We live in one of the safest cities in America, and we ought to keep these sentences.
All right. Well, that's Dan Conley. He's district attorney for Suffolk County. And Daniel Medwood is a professor of professor of law at Northeastern University. Gentlemen, thank you both very much for debating this important issue with us. We're very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anthony.
Thanks very much.
Coming up, Shakespeare and Company's Tina Packer on the women of William Shakespeare's plays. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.